We are at the fifth chapter of Romans, and we had looked last week at the paradoxical nature of the peace of God, which the believer experiences in the power of God. And now Paul continues the argument by talking about the dominion or the reign of Christ as the last Adam. And we pick up then at the 12th verse. Therefore, as sin came into the world through one man, and death through sin, and so death spread to all men, because all men sinned. Sin indeed was in the world before the law was given, but sin is not counted where there is no law. Yet death reigned from Adam to Moses, even over those whose sins were not like the transgression of Adam, who was a type of the one to come. Now, I think that if we get one thing fairly clear in our minds, everything else will be more or less clear. In our minds. And the one thing is this, that Paul is not speculating here. He's not giving us an ideology, that is, a theory of how sin appeared in the world. And I think all kinds of mischief has been created because this whole section has been understood as speculation or has been understood as an explanation. Well, what Paul is really doing is describing the situation. And when we get that clearly in our minds, then we are able to hear what it is that he has to say. And what he has to say, again, is that there are two possibilities in the world. Only two. And there is no possibility of neutrality in the world. And the possibilities are, one will live under the power of the world, and the world in rebellion against God, or one will live under the power of God in obedience to God. Now, and all of this language that seems so strange to us here is Paul's way of describing this situation apocalyptically. That is, in terms of the revelation that is given in Jesus Christ and the revelation that will be given at the end. Let's see. Okay? Now, I've said a whole lot there quickly, and do you want to ponder that before we look at this in more detail? Because I think it's essential that we get these matters sorted out in our minds, because if they are not sorted out with some clarity, then confusion will reign. Okay? Pete.
Does necessitate a decision on the part of the hearer.
Oh, yes. But it is a decision that is always made in terms of the reality of power. Power that is exerted. The decision is never made in isolation. And one of the things that is so important is to see that Paul never isolates the individual from a field of power. Therefore, he talks about the destiny of an individual. An individual who is laid hold upon, who is in bondage to, you see, who is ruled by powers outside the individual. And when you begin, if you talk about decision in isolation from that field of power, then your anthropology, I think, is a sort of modern anthropology that doesn't take into account the profound depths of Pauline anthropology. Okay? Now, we'll come back to this when we look in detail at the first verse. That is at the 12th verse. But I think your question is an important question. Are there other questions? Yes.
You said that Paul is not giving an ideology about how.
My southern pronunciation is probably messing you up, but it's etiology. See, a theory of how things come to be. He's not giving us that kind of notion. He intends to confront us with our history. No.
So are you saying then the danger of assuming this is an etiology?
Yeah.
Or speculation is that it doesn't confront us personally then?
Well, it allows us to begin to ask the question, how did sin get into the world? You know, that's an interesting, every Sunday school class you've ever dealt with is interested in exploring that with you. And what it does is to bring you to the realization that you don't know much about that. See, what you know is sin. Huh? And Paul wants you to know that in its depth, in its existential depth. And you know it in its existential depth when you understand sin in terms of the powers that are at work in you. Don't, I guess another way to say that, don't underestimate the enemy. Don't underestimate the ruin that is in the world because of the power of sin. Huh? Sin is a power. Sin cannot be reduced to the titillating peccadilloes of human adventure. We would like to major in that, wouldn't we, you know? And so we make a parade of our little sins. Paul is absolutely serious about this matter. He is talking about sin as a power that lays hold of one.
Paul doesn't understand sins as we normally think of them. In other words, like transgressions.
Well, he does talk about transgression, but it is basically rebellion, it seems to me. It is allegiance to a power.
Not breaking of a code or law.
It's a breaking of the first commandment. It seems to me he's talking very clearly about Adam's transgression. Yeah, Sylvia?
So is that all he's going to say about the origin of sin?
He's not going to say anything about the origin of sin. That's going to help much. I think he is dualistic at this point. No. Again, not in some sort of metaphysical sense, but in the sense that experience reveals that we are in a field of conflicting powers. Huh? Well, let's look at this then, and maybe in terms of looking at the specifics, the questions will be sharpened. Therefore, as sin came into the world through one man, and death through sin, so death spread to all men, because all men sinned. Now he's talking about Adam, and he's talking about Adam's rebellion against God, Adam's disobedience. Sin is then in the world, and what Adam represents is the reign of sin in the world, the power of sin. And the consequence of sin is death, not understood as natural death, but as understood as the ruin of creation, you see. The wrath of God is again being invoked here, and what God does is to turn the rebels over to themselves. Now, he is saying that to be in the world and to be human is to be in the field of Adam's power. That is the reign of Adam. Adam rules in the world. And then this is the cosmic situation. You understand? He's talking about fallen creation here. And that's the only world that there is. There is no ideal world somewhere. The only world we know is a fallen world. That is a world that lacks the glory of God. Now that is the profound understanding of evil that Paul is working with here. Okay? That's the cosmic dimension of it. And he then goes on to say that every individual sinner is the instrumentality of that cosmic ruin. Now, if he had not, therefore, as sin came into the world through one man, and death through sin, and so death spread to all men, and it's the end of this that creates the problem, because all men sinned. You see, here it is, the destiny of the world is death. And the destiny of the world is determined by the power, the reign of Adam in the world. And that has ruined everything. But that ruin is also individual. And every individual sinner in disobedience participates in the ruin of the world. Now, why is he doing that? Why did he introduce the because all men sinned at the end of this? You have it yet?
Does he want them to realize it's to all of them? It's not just to one group?
He's already done that, it seems to me. He's already set up the universal consequence the universal reality. And now what is universal and cosmic, he is individualizing. And why does he do that?
Concept of original sin, that we all then carry the sin of Adam on, that the human condition comes from the original sin. Doesn't he promote the original sin concept?
I don't think that's in the text. No. That's the way that gets systematized. Maybe the notion is embedded here, yes.
It seems to me what Paul's doing here is destroying the argument of using Adam as a scapegoat.
Oh!
That we can pass the
buck. Yeah. See, what Paul wants to establish is responsibility. That is, it would appear to me that this is just simply the reverse of what we'll be dealing with later when we talk about salvation. See, the two things that are held here in tension is the fact that there is this sovereignty in the world, and that every person participates in the sovereignty of Adam, the rule of Adam, but every person participates in it responsibly. He is a part of the rebellion against God. Mm-hmm. Are you? Yes.
So if every man participates in it responsibly,
yes.
The sovereignty of Adam, is that the place where one begins to acknowledge God? I mean, so what?
Well, so this is the place where one acknowledges lordship. That's it, you see. And that's what he means here, it seems to me, when he says, because all men sinned. Because all men acknowledge a Lord. Does that help?
Yeah.
You see, you cannot live as a human being except under a Lord. That's Paul's anthropology. Now, you are destined because of Adam to live in a world where the field of Adam's power is exerted upon you all the time. Now, take this seriously, because it will have a whole lot to do with how seriously you take salvation. Huh? All right, let's continue then. Sin indeed was in the world before the law was given, but sin is not counted where there is no law. Now, what Paul is doing is relating this cosmic understanding to the particular history of the Jews. And he's also insisting that sin is present before the law, as Paul is using the term here, the Mosaic law, was given. But that sin is literally, no, figuratively, I guess, not chalked up, that is, not counted, because it is not seen as transgression of the law. Now, yet, and what?
What does he mean by that?
Well, he's talking about the situation. He's got a very specific notion of this. Adam is given a commandment, right? And Adam breaks it. So Adam is a transgressor. And through Adam's transgression, a whole field of power known as sin is released in the world. And from Adam until Moses, persons live under the dominion of sin because of Adam's transgression. But sin here is not breaking of the commandment in the sense of Adam's breaking of the commandment, you see. That's what turned everything loose, according to Paul's understanding. Okay? Now, although persons who live between Adam and Moses, according to Paul's interpretation of this, and it's important for him to set this up, because that would also be the Gentile situation, wouldn't it? And although the Gentiles are not transgressors, they are under the power of sin. Okay? And this is a working out in specific detail of the analysis that he gives in the first chapter, beginning at verse 18 through the conclusion of that chapter. Okay? Yes.
Is that saying that during this time then there was an excuse?
No. It is saying exactly the opposite. It's saying that what is present always in this situation is the Creator, and under the power of sin there is the decision to live in rebellion against God. And the end here is death, ruin. See.
What does he mean when he says that sin is not counted?
What?
That sin is not counted.
Well, it's not counted as a breaking of the law. It's not chalked up. And he has a picture here of the record book in heaven, you know. And so when you break the specific commandments, then the imagery there, the mythology is that you get a black mark. And he's talking about that imagery. He's just saying it's not chalked up that way. But the consequences of it is death.
Nevertheless, death.
Oh, exactly. And he's done that, you see, in talking about the Gentile situation in the first chapter. But he's returning to that same issue here. And what it's important to see is that Paul is not just sort of doing a stream of consciousness thing. He has a very clear notion, and he keeps working with that, going back and picking up themes and developing them throughout the letter. One of the things that will help you is when you're reading a commentary, read it as a commentary. You see, That is, have some way of having text open before you so that you can move back and forth. You can't do that very well in a commentary. Do you understand? Some of you have expressed to me difficulty with Casement, and there's difficulty with Casement at the best because we're just not prepared to deal with this, are we? But a lot of the difficulty comes from our attempt to read as if Casement were writing some sort of independent work. He's not. He is writing a commentary on the text. And if the text isn't there before you, and if you're not working back and forth in the text, then the commentary doesn't shed much light. Okay? That's a sort of an excursus there, but I think it's important. Yes?
When you talk about the death of creation.
Yes, the ruin of creation.
Which existed because of sin between Adam and Moses.
Yeah.
Abraham was in there.
Yes.
Okay. Where does that put me at? When you say death of creation, you're not talking about eternal death, are you?
Yes. Are you? Yeah. He's talking about the fact that unless something is done in this situation to change it, the inevitable consequence of Adam's rebellion and that rebellion becoming existentially present in the rebellion of every sinner, you know, is death. Okay? Now, what about Abraham? The issue with Abraham is that Abraham is a type, a prototype of the intervention of God on behalf of the creation. Yeah.
But I can see a church member saying, but wait a minute, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, they must be resurrected. And if we put them there.
Well, Paul is going to talk about that too. That's a good question. You see, the issue is that Paul is always looking toward the future. And he's looking toward the future triumph of God. And he has in his understanding a resurrection that will bring everybody before the judgment seat, before the throne of God at the end. Now, what salvation really is in Paul, this is just to sort of show you the relationship of this to what we've already done, but what salvation really is to stand before the judgment seat. That is to stand before the throne of God and to stand there, and all of the evidence would require that God say no. What salvation is that at the end, God says yes. And Paul says that nobody is going to stand at that point on the basis of his or her performance. Everybody stands on the basis of Abraham.
Then why does Paul say in the 24th verse of chapter 4, it will be reckoned to us who believe in him that raised him from Jesus from the dead? It sounds like a limitation there. You got by a couple days ago, I want to know now.
Again, what Paul is talking about is the appropriation of the yes. And he's saying that, Moses is out of place here. I hope nobody will take this diagram seriously as a chronological chart of what happened. But what he's saying is that the yes of God makes possible in human history our yes. Huh? And that is already an anticipation of the salvation which comes at the end. He is talking, I told you that what he's doing here when he says because all men sin, huh? Notice the universality of that, huh? What he's talking about is the existential appropriation of the ruin that is created by the reign of Adam. In faith, he is also talking about the existential appropriation of the restoration which is made in Christ. And our tendency is to interpret that as a limitation on the power of God's yes. I don't think that that is the necessary consequence of that. I had to deal with that earlier today. I didn't deal with it any more satisfactorily then than I have here.
What you're saying is God's yes makes our yes possible.
I am saying that, and I would insist that God's yes is the ultimate word. That any word that we speak in response to God is what? Penultimate at best? Huh? Yes?
So how can that not be manifest in some form of words?
Well, he never says that it doesn't take shape in human history. And that's what the sixth chapter is all about, I think. Well, let me continue here. Yet death reigned from Adam to Moses, even over those whose sins were not like the transgression of Adam, who was a type of the one who was to come. Now, what Paul is doing is insisting on the uniqueness of Adam, the once-for-allness of Adam, okay? And he's doing that not because of his preoccupation with Adam, but because of his concern to establish the uniqueness and once-for-allness of Christ. And he's saying that what this strange language about Adam is intended to illuminate the Christian experience of the Lordship of Christ. That's what that's all about. Huh? I'm trying to help you cut through this very, very obscure and difficult language to get at the heart of the Pauline proclamation. And what the Pauline proclamation is sort of given here in this word type. See, that is a loaded word. Yet death reigned from Adam to Moses, even over those whose sins were not like the transgression of Adam, who was a type of the one who was to come. Now, that doesn't mean that Adam is a model of Jesus. It doesn't mean that Adam is a paradigm of Jesus. It means that Adam, in the uniqueness of Adam's rebellion against God, is the antithesis of, antitype of Christ, you see. And what Paul is doing is setting up these two antithetical dominions that are represented on the one hand by Adam's rebellion, breaking of the commandment, on the other hand by Jesus Christ, who keeps the commandment, whose obedience restores the creation that has been ruined in the disobedience of Adam. Huh? Yeah.
And therefore, the ultimate place where they met would be crucifixion. And that was the...
Paul is not concerned with the restoration of Adam. See, he doesn't do anything to redeem Adam. He is concerned with the redemption of the creation that has been ruined by Adam. Huh? And Jesus is not Adam redivivus. Yes.
He does this to describe the uniqueness of both.
Yeah.
Characterize Stephen's history,
but
its beginning and its
end. That's right. Again, Caseman, you know, read the section in Caseman carefully. Just read through that over and over again. And what you have here is the sovereignty of primal time contrasted with the sovereignty of end time. And the sovereignty of primal time is seen in the disobedience of Adam. Now, what Paul is doing is saying that the end time has already invaded the sphere of Adam's rule. And since that is the case, you are confronted in primal time with a decision about end time. It is closely related to the two eons that we looked at last week. Okay? Who was a type of the one who was to come. That Adam is important because Adam is the manifestation of the power of rebellion against God, and that is seen in contrast with the power of obedience to God. Now, okay, but the free gift is not like the trespass. For if many died through one man's trespass, much more have the grace of God and the free gift in the grace of that one man, Jesus Christ, abounded for many. And the free gift is not like the effect of that one man's sin. For the judgment following one trespass brought condemnation, but the free gift following many trespasses brings justification. If because of one man's trespass death reigned through that one man, much more will those who receive the abundance of grace and the free gift of righteousness reign in life through the one man, Jesus Christ. And the recurring motif in that section is much more. And it is the apocalyptic much more, you see. It is the much more that has been accomplished by the reign of Christ, established in the crucifixion of Christ, and in the resurrection of Christ. See? Well, the emphasis is upon free gift. And the free gift is for many. No matter how seriously Paul takes this field of sovereignty, it is not ultimate. Okay?
Why is the emphasis on the free gift for many rather than free gift for all?
Well, that is for all. That's what he's driving at here.
Okay.
Yes. It is hoi polloi. You've heard of that, haven't you? That is good news. Hoi polloi. You see. And what Paul is saying is that the grace of God, the power of God, the love of God is invincible. He doesn't for a minute sentimentalize the world. The world is ruined. Right? He doesn't say that there's something there lurking in the dark caverns of the soul that is waiting to burst into beauty. He's saying that everything that is there is bad and it's going to ruin everything. He doesn't leave you any place to stand. Notice here, after he has talked about death reigning, then how he begins the 15th verse. But, and that is the eschatological reversal, but, the free gift is not like the trespass. For if many died through one man's trespass, much more have the grace of God and the free gift in the grace of that one man, Jesus Christ, abounded for many. And the free gift is not like the effect of that one man's sin. For the judgment following one trespass brought condemnation, but the free gift following many trespasses brings justification. If because of one man's trespass, death reigned through that one man. And here, again, notice the word reign. These are kingdoms in conflict. But what Paul is saying is that it is a conflict whose outcome has already been determined. Why? Because it is God who is the gift. See, the gift is not something else. All in the world that Paul is talking about is God, God's giving of God's self. And what Paul is saying is that no matter what has happened here and no matter how serious it is, God is there for us.
I think just to summarize what Paul is talking about is that in Adam, the reign of death is released in the world. And that reign of death spreads through all, as Caseman says, like an infectious disease. And then, by contrast, the reign of life is established through Jesus Christ. Now, you must be careful, then, not to assume that Paul is talking about Adam and Christ in the same way. He is not. See, Adam is always a part of creation. Christ, for Paul, is always more than creation, pre-existent, the instrumentality of creation, a participant in God. Therefore, Christ is the revelation of God. This is one of the dangers that you have in existentialist interpretation of the passage. See, the existentialist interpretation of the passage reduces Christ to the level of human history. And what Paul is insisting is that there is no one on the level of human history who has the power to save human history. And if Jesus is reduced to anthropology, then the Lord of life is canceled out. Or another way that this is, and Caseman's commentary is so helpful, if Jesus is reduced to the embodiment of the covenant community, however that is understood, in terms of fellowship or mysticism or corporate personality, the Lord of the community has been canceled out. And what Paul is concerned to do is to present Jesus as the incomparable Lord of human history. And anthropology and ecclesiology in Paul are always subordinated to Christology. Yes.
If that's so, then how can Paul know that Christ lives in him? If he doesn't know Christ, I mean, if Christ is unknowable...
He doesn't say that you don't know. You know it in confessing a Lord. Yeah.
Confessing what?
A Lord, the Lordship of Jesus, obeying Jesus. See, this again is shows the kind of the subtlety of Paul's mind. Jesus, who is not a part of our world, becomes obedient in our world as the fulfillment of our world. Huh? And through faith, we then participate in the reign of Christ as we are obedient in our world. It is a decision, and Paul would say that in the world, the Christian is like everybody else, subject to the assault of the world. So that the Christian comes to a moment of faith because of the power of God. But that moment of faith does not remove the Christian from the world. So the Christian always lives in the world under the attack of the world. Now, how can the Christian persist? The Christian persists in hearing the gospel. Well, the hearing of the gospel is the place where the battle is joined. Am I responding to your question at all, Sylvia?
Yes. I feel rebellious.
Well, that's all right. You know, the fact that you don't believe this is perfectly all right. I mean, you're free. You're free to shake your head and say, this is nonsense. Beware, but... Oh.
Well, it just sounds to me like there's this Lord and then there's me, and only that God acts. Can I act? I mean, that's okay. I want to be able to
Well, of course you do, and I want to, and I insist on it, and that is in Paul's judgment sin, and it reflects. Now again, you don't have to believe that or not. You just that what we're doing is trying to do exegesis, and if the exegesis leads us to the point where we see how strange Paul is over against our assumptions, the exegesis is working. Apparently, it's working very well.
There is one thing that got me, and it says, in case he says Christ undoubtedly does not abstractly represent humanity, nor is he concretely one individual among and alongside others.
Oh, no. Exactly.
He is the pre-existent one that was born and the designated cosmic creator.
Oh, exactly.
But now, that's so and opposite, the opposite to what we've always been.
Oh, doing. Yes. Yes.
I always thought of one being able to see the Christ man being a representative of us.
He walks with me and talks with me. chuckles with me. Well, now, if you had emphasized the last part of that gospel song, you'd be in the right track. Yes, exactly. He tells me I am his own. That sets you in a different world.
But you can't be like him according to this.
Well, you can't be like him in the sense that you... Oh, that is precisely what we must be and what we are always seeking to be. That is, lords of our own life. You know?
So monkey wrenching
And regardless of whether you are willing to accept what Paul is doing here, please pay attention to what he is doing. You know, he is taking the human situation seriously. And how much more demanding this is than the kind of stuff that we read in the Reader's Digest. Or the funny paper, or whatever else there is that comes down the pike. All right. Then, as one man's trespass led to condemnation for all men, hear that, so one man's act of righteousness leads to acquittal and life for all men. Now he explicates this in the 19th verse, for as by one man's disobedience many were made sinners, so by one man's obedience, many will be made righteous. Now, it doesn't talk about going into righteousness. It doesn't. I was pondering this in my little prune heart last night, you know, and I began to realize what a heresy is involved in the ordination question, are you going on to perfection? See, there is in Paul no developmental possibility that brings you to sanctification. Sanctification is like justification. It is the pure, unconditioned gift of God and has to be claimed over and over again in the concrete circumstances of one's life. It's not continuing in the path of pale Methodist piety.
Huh? Isn't it though a discovery not so much of what I'm now able to do or what I'm able to yield to God, but a discovery of how much more God is Lord?
Oh!
I learn it only little by little.
Oh, oh, but you don't, you don't. You're learning it is not the condition for it. See, that's the trick. It is there. It is the given. It is the free gift of God.
More and more.
Mm-hmm. Much more. But not in the sense of some kind of progression along a scale from 1 to 10. Watch it. And somebody's working on the developmental stuff about the stages of faith, you know. I hope that... Oh, you're doing that, aren't you? I should not reveal my hand, but why not? It seems to me that what is greatly needed in Christian education is a critical look at that. A critical look at that. In light of Paul's apocalyptic view of salvation as the triumph of God. Huh? The hidden agenda is always to move you to some more acceptable plane. Huh? And what happens is, when you are moved to some more acceptable plane, you are still under the reign of death. Whether you have made the movement on the basis of your own great effort, or whether that's something that somebody has done to you through propaganda, manipulation, the end is the same. Well, that comes out here. For as by one man's disobedience many were made sinners, that is, by one man's presumption to be Lord of his life, the whole thing is ruined. So by one man's obedience many will be made righteous. As God does in Christ what we cannot do for ourselves, righteousness is established. Law, now, you see, but we were not on some tangent when we were talking about this business, because it's precisely what Paul is dealing with. Law came in to increase the trespass, but where sin increased, grace abounded all the more, so that as sin reigned in death, grace also might reign through righteousness to eternal life through Jesus Christ our Lord. Now, what Paul is saying is that there is no way to get from the reign of Christ to the reign of Adam. There is no connecting of the two. They are inseparable. And the law will not bring them together. All the law does is to underscore the reality of the rebellion. Now, what is the law? The law, as Paul is using it here, is righteousness understood as a human achievement. Performance of the law, however noble, however virtuous, availeth nothing. It goes nowhere.
except to bring to light more vividly the reality of death. Now, that's what Paul is saying here. See, you see how Paul has anticipated the discussion that we've been having. That what we cling to, and here, please don't conclude that I'm scolding any of you who were talking. I'm not, because you were just speaking for all of us. See, what we cling to is our own lordship. Now, but where sin increased, grace abounded all the more. Now understand, grace has power. See, whereas the power of rebellion is turned loose in the world, the power of God is again eschatological, apocalyptic, in the sense that it is all the more. The power of God is incomparable. So that as sin reigned in death, and notice how Paul sticks to the language of sovereignty, the language of a field of power, so that as sin reigned in death, grace also might reign through righteousness to eternal life through Jesus Christ our Lord. Well, what Paul has done here is to describe the situation of salvation and damnation by using mythology, the mythology of Adam, and the mythology of Christ, mythological figures, the one man of rebellion, the one man of obedience. Now, how is it that Paul is able to go from the Jesus of history to this kind of Christological understanding? And that's one of the issues that Caseman pursues in this section. And I think he's right, and I simply call this to your attention so that if you're interested, you might want to pursue it. It is through the figure of wisdom, wisdom that is personified in the Old Testament and becomes the agent of mediation between God and the world, and also is understood as the agent of the creation of the world. And one of the most productive sources of Paul's theology in Caseman's understanding, and I think also in mine, is simply this wisdom speculation that had developed in Judaism, especially in Hellenistic Judaism. Now, one of the best places to pursue this in some depth is W.D. Davies' book, Paul and Rabbinic Judaism. And you might want to take a look at that. Because this is not just a passing notion in Paul. It is at the very heart of his argument in the Corinthian correspondence. Now,
Why was it easy for Paul to connect this Jesus of history with the figure of wisdom? Because Jesus had already become the voice of wisdom in his words. See? See? Well, it's fascinating to begin to consider how that Paul is reworking again the tradition of his own religion in order to proclaim the gospel. It is literally the case that he became all things to all men, that he might by all means save some. What seems so odd and strange to us is odd and strange to us because we are not familiar with the traditions that Paul is working with. Okay? All right, what shall we say then? And here's I can already see you here. You're saying enough already. What shall we say then? Are we to continue in sin that grace may abound? And Paul just simply dismisses this, as is so often again. By no means. Let's see. How can we, who died to sin, still live in it? You see, how can we, who have died to the reign of sin, still live in that to which we have died? See? It's incomprehensible. It's impossible. It's absurd. That's what he's saying. Now, the absurdity theologically is the reality existentially. That's the reason he's addressing this, you see. What he's doing is saying it is absurd theologically, but existentially your life is a paradox of what you really are. That is, it is a contradiction of what you are. Huh? Now, this is strange. No. Do you not know that all of us who have been baptized into Christ Jesus were baptized into his death? We were buried, therefore, with him by baptism into death, so that as Christ was raised from the dead by the glory of the Father, we too might walk in newness of life. Well, this is magic, isn't it? Huh? Every immersionist really seizes on this thing. Well, finally, we've got a text. Or every person who is concerned to establish the fact of salvation upon something that we do will say, here at last, we have been given the justification for believers' baptism, and that salvation is a result of our believing. Huh? What's he talking about?
Seems to be just the opposite.
What does it mean?
It seems to be just the opposite of our doing something.
Oh!
It seems to completely take away
oh.
the
anything that we could possibly do in it.
Oh, see, now, if we got that nailed down and write that at the top of the page, underscored about 15 times, that baptism in Paul is not what we do, but it is what is done for us. Huh? It's like the gospel. It is the gospel. See? Baptism is the power of God. Baptism is the righteousness of God. Therefore, Paul doesn't tell you anything about the correct liturgy. Isn't that funny? Or he doesn't tell us anything about what they said before or what they did. He doesn't talk about that. And he tells you nothing about how it was done, to our great consternation. Huh? He talks about it as the act of God, the power of God. It is the power of God that creates, that establishes a new reign in human history and transfers us, nobody believes this, transfers us out of the old reign into the new reign, transfers us out of the reign of death into the reign of life. Isn't that amazing? I never really thought about that very much, but you know, to this, how odd it is that we have this baptismal font stuck down there at the front of the church. You know, and what is it? That baptismal font is the armament. Of the church. The baptism is war. Maybe the act of baptism is important because from the standpoint of what we do, it is so ridiculous. What could be more absurd?
The transference that you talked about occurs with or without a baptism.
Now that's like saying that it's a. It seems to me he's making a whole lot of baptism. He's not saying baptism is optional. He's talking about entrance into the reign of God. And what he's doing is saying that you enter into the reign of God through baptism. It is an initiation rite, isn't it? Huh? And you can't get in any other way. It's a public decision. You show your colors. Here you are. Yes, but by no means is it your decision.
That's the point I'm trying to understand.
I hope. Says, never conclude that it is your decision. See, what is constitutive of salvation is God's act.
Well, why does he say no one can be neutral if it's not our decision? That's what.
Because you cannot live. You cannot be a person except under lordship.
No, I
am not going to explain that any better than Paul does and any better than Casaubon does.
Then
logically, it is incomprehensible. You know?
Well, then why is there such a strong thing with Paul? You have to make sure that you... It's almost like he's forcing the next to do something.
Well, it's quite clear that he is working with the tradition and he is laboring with an exegetical problem.
And I think he's working with an exegetical problem that is our existential problem. No. He's working with an exegetical problem that he has sensed in the Roman Church. Namely, a tendency to understand baptism magically. Ex opere operato. And Paul is saying no to that. But he is also taking baptism seriously as the act of God. Okay? The baptism, as I understand it, as he's talking about it here, is an entrance into the obedience of Christ. That is the death of Christ, isn't it? It is an entrance into the reign of Christ. Now, what shape does that take? It takes the shape of life in the world. Now, the heresy that Paul is attacking is the notion that it takes the shape of life out of the world. The heresy that Paul is attacking is those who said that because we have been baptized with Christ, we have been raised up with Christ into a life that no longer experiences the limitations, the challenges, the assaults of life in the world. And what he's doing is helping the Romans to get in touch with baptism as the entrance into life in the world under the sign of the cross. Now, to die with Christ in obedience is to live with Christ in obedience in the world. It is not to be cut loose from the necessity of hearing and obeying the gospel.
Yes.
I don't understand what Paul would say about infants
in baptism. Yes, what would he say?
Because you just said that we have to hear the gospel, and we have a choice to make.
Well, he's going to say that, but he's going to say, what?
But it's still a reception.
Oh, yes. And if it is the act of God, then how do we stand in relationship to baptism? All of us. Huh?
Resistance.
Oh. What?
Naked.
Yes. Exactly. Babies. Huh? Helpless. Huh? Think that through. Think it through. And then be prepared to talk about it. See, we do not believe in order to baptism. That's a heresy. We are baptized into faith. Huh? Huh? So, Paul is here not developing a systematic theology of baptism, but I would suspect that if you pay attention to this, you have the ingredients of a systematic theology of baptism. How you would
that? It follows then that it seems to justify those who say anyone can baptize anyone, because anyone who has been baptized into the reign.
Paul doesn't talk about that at all. I would understand that since he doesn't talk about it, the only concern would be that it be done decently and in order.
I'm not sure that he's concerned with what we're concerned with. That is, it is not a legitimate baptism unless a legitimate person does it. And Paul would say, there's no such thing as a legitimate person. We're all bastards. Exactly.
The sacrament of baptism, we perceive it has to be done by an ordained person, sacrament, I don't know what.
Only in the sense that that person represents the community, and if the person represents the community, then he doesn't represent or she doesn't represent the community in any sense except as the community is. And you know what the community is.
through all of this, clearly Paul's emphasis is on our personal responsibility.
No. I think his emphasis is on God's action. It seems to me that our concern about responsibility is a way of bootlegging in our own righteousness. And we must with Paul stand at the door and resist that with every ounce of our understanding and strength. Betty?
Entrance into the obedience of God is an act of God.
Oh, yes. You cannot.
So then it's not dependent on us sprinkling water on each other.
No.
That's just a sign that has occurred, right? And it points to a reality that's already present.
It is there. It is, again, it seems to me, Paul's way of working with what he had received. He didn't make up baptism. It's there. It's always been there, as far as I can see. The text suggests that. Doesn't he say, don't you know? Pay attention to what Paul says, don't you know? What he's doing is saying, you have this tradition, but you don't know the way you ought to know, and I'm going to set you straight. when he says, don't you know, he is really relying upon the consensus in the community. Huh? But then he is concerned to think through that tradition in terms of the particular problem that has arisen in the church. So he's working with what is given in light of, as Baker points out in his book, the contingencies of the situation.
I guess.
Now we're just a little later. I get off on one of these tears, but I think it's an important tear. You see, what we have done then is to take the text out of its context and begin to argue to establish our own ideology in ways that take us out of the contingencies of our situation. See? Mm-hmm. And that is to misuse the text. See? Okay, now.
I guess what I'm struggling with this is, it looks to me like Paul is saying you need to be baptized in order to be in the reign of God, obedience, whatever.
No.
And that seems...
He's talking to people who have been baptized. Mm-hmm. Not talking, saying to people, you need to be baptized. He's saying, you have been baptized. Get that. See, he's not going around exhorting. And Paul would agree that anabaptism is a heresy. You are that is the once for allness of the Christian experience. Now then, he's going to relate that, though, to the recurring challenge and assault that faith experiences in the world. And that's what follows in the rest of this chapter. You don't reproduce the unique consequence of Adam's rebellion. You live in a world that is already destined by that. And you participate in that destiny. And that destiny is realized through your own concrete rebellion against God.
Well, where does our responsibility come into it?
Always responsible.
I must be dense here, but I'm trying to understand.
Well, you're not dense. I'm just not very helpful.
If we have no choice, that's the point. That it seems like then we're just existing robots if we have no choice in it.
Well, now I'm not willing to say that Paul says we have no choice.
But then it goes back to the argument. If we have a choice, then Paul is speaking against infant baptism.
Well, yeah. It seems to me that whether he's speaking for or against infant baptism is irrelevant at this point. That's not the issue. And let me just call attention to the fact that the issue that you are pressing about our responsibility, I think, is one that will not resolve itself in some neat solution. I think that what Paul is trying to do is to get us in touch with the fact that we live already in a world that is ruled by sin and death, and that we participate in that rule through our own concrete acts of rebellion and sin against God. Now, that is the basic issue. And then to try to explain that, I think, is to try to get us off the hook somewhere. Caseman's explanation that he uses repeatedly in dealing with this is to say everything is seed and everything is fruit. I haven't the foggiest notion what that means, but it's a good thing for you to ponder during the holidays. And I wish you a blessed Christmas.